Nothing in this crate over here. Nothing in this one either. God, I hate searching these old bombed-out buildings for ammunition. I better hurry up and get out of here before a super mutant comes waltzing in or something.
Oh, I smell human.
Oh, jeez, what are the odds of that?
Oh,
oh crap!
Die, puny human!
Oh, no! I've got to find a way to... Wait a second. Is that clock on the wall behind you the right time?
Huh?
Oh, man. We're going to have to just go ahead and postpone the maiming and death here. It's time for Through the Aftermath.
Oh? Aftermath happy time.
Wait, you listen to the podcast too? Now, what are the odds of that? Well, we're going to need something to listen to it on.
Use human talking cube on cable.
Human talking cube? Oh, the radio. Well done. Man, you mutants aren't totally as stupid as I thought.
Huh?
All right, we should be able to tune right into it here. You know, when I started my day this morning, I never thought in a million years I'd be listening to a podcast with a super mutant, but, there it is.
Crazy.
And, of course, our next show is brought to you by the Craterside Supply in Megaton. The best supplies for your own... What? When did that happen? Oh. Well, I've just learned from the producers that Megaton actually exploded, so today's show will be brought to you by Tenpenny Towers. That's right, it's time for Through the Aftermath.
Hello and welcome back to Through the Aftermath. This is episode number 4, and I am your host, Sean Schuster, and with me again is my co-host, Jonathan. How are you doing, Jonathan?
I am doing great once again. I am back in the studio this time. As you see, you were probably really glad to hear me knock on the bunker door for once.
Oh yeah, you made it, huh?
Yeah, I finally did. It was kind of embarrassing because I very nearly got killed by a blowfly of all things after being held by the Raiders for so long, which, not to pimp the own show here, but the Online Gamers Anthology, you're going to hear a little more about what happened during that week. So yeah, it's good to be back. It's good to be finally back in the studio and, things are going fantastic.
Sweet. Very cool. Yeah, this show, we are going to, of course, do the regular news and emails. And we have a main topic this time, and it's A Boy and His Dog. It's a movie made in 1974, and it stars Don Johnson, and it's one of his first movies. Not his very first, one of his first movies. So we'll be talking a lot more about that. It's definitely a cult classic, I guess you could say. And that will be our main topic. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about what we've been up to in the post-apocalyptic world. Have you been doing any reading or watching any movies or anything?
You know what? I've been reading a few books, listening to a few books on tape. Like recently, I was actually, I was looking for just about anything that I could grab post-apocalyptic, and I was looking through the Stephen King's Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which are probably like my favorite set of books that he does.
Yeah.
And he does this one story called The End of the Whole Mess. And so the other day I was actually listening to that, and that's going to be – we'll have to talk about that in a future episode because that storyline – and those of you who saw the Nightmares and Dreamscapes special on TNT a while back, you probably – they actually did a live version of that, which was really cool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He does a lot of great post-apocalyptic stuff. Even the stuff that he did with the Gunslinger and all that, that was some pretty good stuff, that whole series. I started reading. I think I'm up to like – book 5 of that.
But
That's still pretty post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, The Gunslinger, you know, and talking to people at work, they're like, if you don't do a storyline, something about the, you know, like an episode about the gunslinger, you guys are crazy. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure we can find a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it definitely, even if it's not necessarily Earth per se, just an alternate version, or an alternate dimension of it, you know, it definitely is a post-apocalyptic world. That's for darn sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's for sure. I've been watching a few movies. Of course, I watched Boy and His Dog. I watched it a couple times actually to get ready for this episode. And I think it was two nights ago, I watched WALL-E. Have you seen that?
You know, I haven't seen WALL-E yet. And shame on me because I'm usually a freak for those Pixar movies.
I know. It's a really good movie. I mean, really, really good. And I guess it could be considered post-apocalyptic because it's basically like the trash just takes over the earth and then the people kind of escape to their own little spaceship utopia out in space. And WALL-E is basically cleaning up, you know, all the trash and everything. So I guess you could consider it that. It was a really interesting story though. It was pretty cool. And, other than that, though, you know, I've been playing Fallout 3. I finally finished Anchorage, Operation Anchorage. You know, I got my new disk drive, my new DVD drive, and popped it in there, and I finished that up, and I really enjoyed it. What was funny, though, is when I stopped playing it, my DVD drive went out. I was about a half hour from the end. I was
right.
So close. So I popped it in. I got ready. I sat down, played it for a half hour, and it was done. And I was like, oh. Okay. That was okay. That was pretty cool. Did you get to finish it?
You know, I will say I finally got back to where I left off. And that includes a lot of the areas in Fallout 3. Cause remember in the last episode, I was telling everybody about how I had to restart, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So I did manage to make it through a lot of the areas. I even managed to go through the Nuka-Cola plant one more time. And that's a bugger of a dungeon.
Yeah. That is.
So. Yeah, now I'm back pretty much where I left off in the first section of Operation Anchorage, and my goal is to have it done by the end of this week, because the closer we get to the pit, and we'll be talking about this shortly, the more I hear about the pit, the more I'm like, okay, is it possible the pit could be better than the original story?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question, yeah. Yeah, it should be exciting. We'll talk about that in a second. A few other things I want to mention just before we get into the meat of the show here is I wanted to thank Mirage for the Fallen Earth Valentine card, which I thought was pretty funny. We mentioned that, I think it was last episode, about the Valentine's cards that they had out. And what it was basically is, you know, you can send someone a Valentine, a Fallen Earth themed Valentine, and you get a chance to be in the closed beta, which is pretty exciting. So I got one from Mirage. He's a listener, and he goes way back to the Guildcast days. He was a listener back then. So thanks, Mirage. It was a great little Valentine's card. My heart was touched.
Yeah, that was very, very kind. When I caught wind of that, I was like, that's really cool.
Yeah. And then also, we have a listener named RC who we read one of his emails last week, and we've corresponded a few times, and he basically, what it is he works for a library, and he's in charge of ordering the sci-fi and fantasy books for the library. So he wrote to me and he says, hey, I would like to be kind of like a behind the scenes contributor, I guess you could say. He wants to give us little bibliographies on post-apocalyptic books. And then I could read them on the show, or we could read them on the show. And I thought that was a great idea. You know, it's not really any kind of a commitment by him as far as, you know, like a regular segment or anything like that. And I know that can turn a lot of people off. But he, you know, he volunteered his services basically on something that he's doing anyway. You know, he's doing it anyway for his job. So one of these, he sent a little one here on a story that we talked about last episode on the book Wasteland Stories of the Apocalypse. Now, when I mentioned this last week, I didn't really know anything about it, you know, because it was mentioned in an email, and I think I said it was like by Stephen King or something like that. But the thing is, it's a compilation, and Stephen King has stories in it. Actually, End of the Whole Mess, the one you mentioned, he actually has that one in there. So here's a little bibliography. It's really short. I'll just read it really quick. This is put together by RC. It says, Wasteland Stories of the Apocalypse is a compilation of 22 dark future tales written over the past 40 years, with over half of them since 2000, by some of the most talented writers in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. From Stephen King's spin on the end of humanity, through Science Gone Wrong, to John Langan's horrific tale of a small group's valiant last stand against an unbeatable enemy. These stories run the gamut from nuclear devastation to environmental debacle to even the Second Coming. Also features contributions by Orson Scott Card, George R. R. Martin, Octavia E. Butler, and Gene Wolfe. There's sure to be something here to please nearly every post-apocalyptic palate. And he says, this is still in print, and it should be readily available at your local bookstore, or better yet, check it out from your local library. If they don't have it, they can certainly borrow it through the interlibrary loan from a library that does. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. And he gave us a list of the contributors in that book, because it's a compilation. And, I think I am definitely going to check this out. I love going to the library and checking out things. We have a pretty small one, though, where I live, so I don't know if they'll have this, but I'm definitely going to check it out.
Yeah, and I stopped at the Barnes & Noble after hearing this, and sure enough, there it was, right on the front shelf, you know, where all the featured books are. And, you know, as soon as I saw that, just by the cover alone, I'm like, yep, that's going to be nuclear right there. So, and it's interesting, because going through the list of the stories that are in it, I know I recognize one of it. You know, The End of the Whole Mess, obviously, you know, is one I just listened to. But in the show comments of our last episode, one of the listeners, Rob G., mentioned that story called When Sysadmins Ruled the Earth, and I've heard about that being a really, really good story, and sure enough, there it is inside that Wastelands collection. So that's one of those I'm going to be probably peeking at first. Not that I would not read it in order, but you know, you always kind of peek through, like, yeah, I want to read that one now, you know. So yeah, I will be picking this up this weekend if everything goes smoothly.
Yeah, that's cool. And George R. R. Martin is one of my favorite authors, and the fact that he wrote one in there too, I think that's pretty cool. So
that is really cool.
Yeah. All right, so now we can go ahead and get into the news, now that we got our little intro out of the way there. And we don't have a ton of news this week, but we do have some pretty exciting news, I guess you could say. And the first and the biggest probably is the Fallout 3 news, like Jonathan was saying earlier about the Pit. You want to talk a little bit about what we know about the Pit so far?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because right after we had done the last episode, lo and behold, some screenshots started to get released, and the more I saw, the more my mouth started to drop. You know, we had talked about in the last episode the fact that, you know, the Pit, you know, it deals with Pittsburgh, and it was not necessarily a city that had been hit directly, but, you know, irradiated. And basically it deals with the slavers and their slaves and this whole kind of, like, uprising in between. And just seeing the screenshots alone, and there's those of you who saw the Game Informer magazine have already, the one with God of War 3 on the cover, have probably already seen this screenshot, but they're showing weapons in this that it almost looks like a weed whacker with giant blades on it, and I was like, what is that? And then, you know, scenes where they would show, like, an oil refinery in the distance, and it sounds like, just from what they alluded to, it sounds like at some point in the story you actually end up getting captured and turned into a slave yourself, and they almost allude to the idea that there is a choice. You can either become one of the slavers or lead the uprising of the slaves. But it almost looks like this story, it's going to be a lot more story-ended than all the rest of them. And so I'm really curious to see how this plays. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, and they've even said that it's a little bit more balanced. You know, they always said with the original Fallout 3 that you can pick good or evil, and you'll pretty much have the same type of experience. Like, you can't really go wrong. But I haven't really found that to be true. You know, if you pick evil, if you go strictly evil, you get a lot of people that don't like you. So it kind of affects your gameplay a little bit. Well, with this, they're saying that it's literally, you can choose each side. You can be either fight for the slaves or the slavers, and you'll get kind of a similar gameplay outcome either way. So I think that's really interesting. Plus, they say that, you know, with Operation Anchorage, it was very linear. And it was pretty much start to finish. This is what you have to do. You know, it's a simulation of the history back, you know, before the war and everything like that. So it was very linear. It was very, you know, you couldn't go outside of this area and things like that. And to me, it was a good, I really enjoyed it, but that was kind of the downfall of it for me. Well, with the Pit, it's supposed to be a lot more choices, you know, a lot more options that you can do. So I think that'll be very interesting, and it might even rival, you know, the original story, which would be very exciting.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it looks, from what I've seen so far, like they're setting the bar really high, and so, you know, I really hope that Broken Steel even takes it further, because if that's the case, the Broken Steel add-on is going to just be insane. But, yeah. I just horrible thought, like, what if the Pittsburgh add-on's better than the ending story? But then there's that part of me that's like, no, you mustn't say that. Go to your room. So, you know, I'm hoping that everything will turn out good. But I'll tell you, the screenshots, especially that one screenshot they have where you're going across the bridge into Pittsburgh, and you can see all the cars, and somebody spray-painted, you know, out the – so all you see is the pit part of Pittsburgh, and it says the pit. And I was – and then you see that wonderful landscape in the distance, and I'm like, that does not look like D.C.
Yeah.
which is silly because it's Pittsburgh. But you know what I'm saying. I mean, like, just the art direction, everything just looks way, way different.
Actually, it's funny. I have a friend who's from Pittsburgh, and he saw those screenshots, and he was like, you know, actually, that looks a lot like Pittsburgh right now. So.
Wow. I cannot wait. I'm telling you, March can't come quick enough.
Yeah. And some of the features that they have listed on one of these articles from shacknews.com, and I'll put these in the show notes. It says, for the features, it says, explore an entire new area, the post-apocalyptic ruins of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Of course, we know that. Find and use new weaponry, such as the auto axe, a new melee weapon with a powerful serrated rotary blade, hungry for flesh. Wow. That's
right out of Dead Space.
Yeah. And it says, discover new side quests and subtle plot elements and determine your path in the place where nothing is right or wrong. I guess that's basically what I was saying before. And then exclusive new perks and achievements. So that should be exciting. Definitely.
Interesting. Very cool.
And I guess the last part of our little Fallout 3 news of the episode, Gamefly actually awarded Fallout 3 with Game of the Year for 2008, and that's also Xbox 360 Game of the Year. So I guess it took home two awards. So that's pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah, it's interesting though, because you compare that, and this is what makes me happy about hearing this, because you compare that to before Fallout 3, before we even had screenshots or anything, and people were just going ape because they were just like, oh, they're going to do it wrong. They're going to screw it up. And now here they are doing, not only did they live up to what they said, and you know, there's probably people out there that would argue this, but, I mean, they're taking award after award, and it just does my heart good, because that just means we're going to get a lot more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially considering how much they sold. You know, right off the bat, Fallout 3, I'm sure they have the funding now to just keep going for a while. And, you know, to be honest, as long as they keep this up, I'm going to keep paying the $10 every couple of months for a new expansion. It's more than worth it to me.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add, too, is wanted to give a quick shout-out. Julie Whitefeather from the podcast No Prisoners, No Mercy, fantastic podcast, I might add. Her and Francis do a fantastic job. She gave us a nice shout-out, gave some nice words about Fallout 3, how much fun she's having playing that. So we wanted to thank Julie and say, you know, thanks for listening, for all your great comments, and thank you so much.
Yeah, actually, there was a comment of hers that I wanted to read a little bit later anyway, we'll get to that. Yeah, and you know, I definitely appreciate that. Definitely, I listened to that podcast too, and it's entertaining to say the least.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, okay, so we'll move on through the news a little bit. We have a couple more pieces here, and a lot of these are just little quick things, like for Terminator Salvation, which is coming out May 21st. You know, we've been talking about that a few times. You know, the whole explosion from Christian Bale and everything, but. Linda Hamilton has been confirmed for a voiceover in the movie, which is pretty cool because she was in the original. Of course, you know, she was the original Sarah Connor.
Oh yeah.
So that'll be cool just to get her back into the movie, even just as a voiceover. And then another piece of news here we have about Fallen Earth. They have a new. It's like a national tour, and not too many companies really do this, especially gaming companies. But what they're doing is they're going around. Like they've done this in Raleigh, North Carolina, and it says that they're planning to do this in Baltimore, San Francisco, and Houston throughout the U.S. They're basically showing people the game. They're going around and showing people live, and you can also interact with the people, you know, the people who made the game, including the lead designer Lee Hammack, and who we've talked about on the show, and a couple other people that are on the team and putting the game together. So. That is kind of cool because it's almost like you don't have to go to a convention to see the game and to see these people, which usually is what happens. It's almost like they're coming to you. So I think that's a pretty cool approach to get the word out about Fallen Earth. And hopefully you'll be hearing a lot more about Fallen Earth on this show. I think I'll just leave it at that.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, I like that. I like that they're doing that tour. It really does show, especially for the devs, how into this game that they are themselves and how excited they are to be able to bring it to us. And we like he said, we'll hopefully be talking a lot more about that soon.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And one other thing I wanted to talk about real quick was, if anyone hasn't seen it, now this isn't really news or anything, but if anyone hasn't seen the new trailer for the movie 9 that's coming out, it's like a animated movie, and it's by Tim Burton, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's Tim Burton and also the director of Wanted.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I'm gonna put a link to the trailer in the show notes for today, but it's really interesting. Like, I saw that trailer. Actually, John showed me that trailer quite a while ago, a couple months ago, about a month ago, and I saw that and I'm like, wow, that looks really cool.
Yeah, it almost seems like, it's hard to tell kind of what the storyline behind it is, but it almost like seems like it was a post-apocalyptic story because of robots. Like, it almost seems like the robots have taken over the world and the humans are now extinct.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, that's been done before, but the way that they do it with these little creatures, little characters, it almost looked like little Big Planet.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They almost look like that, but yeah, it looks like a pretty cool little trailer. And if anyone hasn't seen it, I just wanted to mention it, you know, just in case anyone hasn't seen it, so they can go check that out. Now, again, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And then the last piece of news before we get into the main topic, I just wanted to talk about this one link that I saw from someone who is a listener named Doomorama. And he we will read an email from him a little bit later, but he has this little thing that I saw on his Twitter, and it's all about like defining the difference between apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic, and dystopian movies, and it gives the definition of each and some examples of each. And I think it's a great little article that I, you know, again, I'm going to link it in the show notes, but I think it's definitely something that that listeners should check out, because we get a lot of emails where people want to know our definitions of, you know, the distinctions between each, and they want to know, you know, what makes up each type of topic like that. And I think that that's a really important thing, because it's, you know, we could talk about all of that stuff on this, especially on the show, and we probably will. You know, we're not going to be too picky about all that. Although, I don't know, we're still trying to define exactly, you know, where we're going to draw the line on what we're going to talk about in the show. But I think that it's, you know, we're not going to be picky as far as, you know, if there's something that kind of cradles that line, then we can always talk about it. So this little article here, I think, is really interesting, because it gives a lot of examples. And I think that, like, for example, if you want to talk about an apocalyptic film, that's more like Terminator 2 and Judgment Day is another good example. You know, basically where the apocalypse is happening during the movie. You know, you get a kind of a before and during type thing. Now, post-apocalyptic, right, of course, is after the apocalypse. You know, with Road Warrior. We already talked about Mad Max, but Road Warrior would be a good one. 12 Monkeys, 28 Days Later. You know, things like that. Rain of Fire. Rain of Fire, I can't wait to talk about that one. I love that.
Yeah, that's going to be fantastic to talk about.
Yeah. And, you know, that's what's funny about it. Every time I start looking through lists like this and things that define the genre, I keep thinking, oh, I can't wait to talk about that one. That's going to be so cool. But, they define those two. And, of course, dystopian is things like 1984 and Soylent Green and Running Man even.
Yeah,
those are examples of that. Yeah, yeah. So it's a great article. I think people should check it out if they want to get more of a definition of what the different subsections mean, and also kind of a better idea of what we'll be talking about on this show.
No, just like you, you know, it's funny, like going through the list of a lot of the classifications for what they have as far as what's dystopian, what's pre-apocalyptic. And now I'm looking through these going, oh, that one we have to talk about, that one we have to talk about. So I think something tells me this podcast is going to be going until the real apocalypse happens. And even then, we're still going to find the technology to keep it going. So, you know.
Yeah.
Hold on to your ham radio.
Well, the only thing that I think we won't probably talk about in this is like dystopian. I mean, I like some of them that are named here, like V for Vendetta, Running Man, 1984. Those are the type that I don't think we'd really talk about. Although there are some like that kind of mix. Like, have you seen the movie Doomsday yet?
Yeah, you're talking about the one where they jump, they have to get the cure to that virus, and so they send that chick in to go get the, is it the cure she's after?
Yeah, and they have the whole part where they're in England, and they go to that one part where there's like the castles, and they pretty much turn like scrap metal back into armor, and
wow.
Kind of like a King Arthur thing. Did you see that part?
I haven't seen it yet, but I noticed it popped up on PlayStation Network's video download, so I'm like, I guess I'll have to add that.
You have to see that movie. We definitely have to talk about that. That is a great movie. I really liked it a lot. But yeah, I could go on and on. I'm sure we could both go on and on about the movies that we need to talk about. And you know, the thing is too, like in a lot of these emails that we're going to read a little bit later, we are getting some wonderful suggestions for books and movies. And you know, even, you know, like comic books and everything that we need to cover. So I greatly appreciate that. And what I'd like to do eventually, I need to put eventually, I need to trademark eventually for me. Eventually I'd like to get to the point where I'm adding a lot of these suggestions for books and movies and everything and compiling it and put it on the website for like a comprehensive list of all of this stuff. So one day I will do that. I'm keeping all the emails. And one day I'll do that. But, yeah, I just wanted to thank everyone for those emails because they are really great.
Yeah, thank you for that.
You ain't pulling that crap on me again. And you can shove that part about how you lost the ability to hunt for food when you learned how to talk.
No food, no females.
After World War IV, your dog will tell you what to do. How to laugh, how to love, how and who to kill.
That stupid broad.
You're so funny when you're sexually frustrated.
Damn it.
So, now that the news is out of the way, we're going to go ahead and get into the main topic of the show, which is A Boy and His Dog, which I mentioned a little bit earlier. It's a 1974 movie, and it's actually based on a 1969 book by Harlan Ellison. And now, the movie had a couple different names. There were... it was also called Psycho Boy and His Killer Dog. It was called Apocalypse 2024. It had a couple different names. It was kind of a low budget movie, and it starred Don Johnson back when he was, you know, like I said, it wasn't his first movie, but it was one of his first. He was still pretty early. He was 25 years old when this movie was made, so he was pretty young. But do you want to talk a little bit about the basic premise of the movie, what it's all about?
Yeah, basically, the story takes place in kind of an alternate timeline, and what it does is it plays off, and a lot of this is coming from the book. In the movie, you get a little bit of touch of what happened, but it's playing out the idea of what if John F. Kennedy didn't get assassinated? What if he had stayed alive and him and the other Kennedys basically, rather than focusing on the space race, decided to advance technology further, and so as the 1960s play out, we surpass the point which we are at right now. So basically, we have androids that do household work, kind of like you see an iRobot. We also do a lot of research into like telepathy and extrasensory perception, and that includes animals as well, which kind of plays into where the whole story has to do with. And it takes place after, I believe it's actually World War IV. We had World War III and then World War IV shortly thereafter. And the story is basically about this young man named Vic, who is, I think at the time he's supposed to be 18.
Yeah,
and he travels with a dog named his name Blood, yes.
Yeah.
And basically the two of them, it's the story about the two of them basically together, and they have kind of this relationship where Vic is helping Blood get food, and meanwhile Blood's job is to basically help Vic sniff out women. No joke. And so the movie has a very dark humor to it, and you know it's. When I think about this movie, I like to classify it as wonderfully twisted because it borderlines on some, you know, topics like, you know, a lot of the things that would happen in a post-apocalyptic setting, like, you know, stealing and rape and that type of thing, but it does it in a very lighthearted, goofy kind of a way. And so it's basically the story of how the story of him and his dog together going through the wasteland.
Yeah. And I think some of the interesting parts about this movie, when I first watched it, I thought this is, you know, Fallout. This is what Fallout is based on. There's basically, you know, there's a vault kind of a situation where he goes underground to a kind of a. It's almost like they made an ideal 50s kind of a world down there, and it's kind of creepy. Like they all wear like mime makeup with little, you know, red cheeks and everything, like, and you know, the white face and everything. Like they're all supposed to be just these perfect little 50s people. And they're, you know, the women are all wearing these big dresses, and it's an underground area. It's actually, they call it Topeka in the movie, because it's supposed to be like below Topeka, Kansas, I guess. But yeah, and basically, like you said, it's kind of a dark movie. You know, it deals with rape and things like that, and kind of what people would do in a situation where there's no rules and everything. And it, from that standpoint, it's kind of a scary movie, but the rest of it is, it's dark, like you said. It's kind of quirky. In the original trailer for the movie, which is on the DVD, which I found kind of interesting, they call it a kinky movie. They call it a kinky sci-fi, which I thought maybe in 1974 that had a different translation. I'm not sure. Yeah,
I know, I'm scratching my head in confusion going, okay.
But, so basically, like, you know, with this movie, like we talked about last episode about spoilers and everything, you know, this movie, its statute of limitations for spoilers is way over. So we're going to go ahead and talk a little bit about the plot. Basically what happens is, you know, this guy, he's got his dog and he can actually talk to his dog, and his dog can talk to him. And the dog is a result of an experiment. And they only briefly mention that in the movie, but in the book they get into it a little bit more. And like you said, you know, the Kennedys pretty much rule the world, or used to rule the world, and they pretty much budgeted all their money, instead of the space program, they budgeted it into technology. And so they have androids, they have these kind of genetically modified dogs that can sniff out things. And what's crazy about it is when this dog, he's kind of a sarcastic dog. I love the dog, so his name is Blood. And he kind of sniffs out women for Don Johnson's character, and he does this crazy, there's this crazy like radar noise sound effect, and it's so 70s. I love it so much. I love quirky mid 70s movies so much, and that's probably one of the reasons I love this movie so much. But yeah, he kind of sniffs out women, and he can pick them out from pretty far away. And there's a couple scenes where, you know, Don Johnson his character's name is Vic. I'm gonna stop calling him Don Johnson. Vic pretty much, you know, he's looking for women, and in exchange, he gets the dog food. It's kind of their deal that they've got going on. But nobody else can hear the dog except Vic. So they end up meeting this one girl, and she has kind of an evil reason for befriending Vic and Blood. Well, kind of Blood. And she leads him down to this underground area that I talked about, the perfect society thing. And the reason they want him is they're kind of stalking him throughout the movie. They're watching him, and they want him to, they basically want his sperm, and, you know, to help, continue on with their civilization and everything. But, there's no procreation going on. It's actually just a sperm donation. So they're trying to get him for that, and then she, you know, it's basically there's some hijinks ensue, and yeah. But the crazy thing is, here's the thing that gets me is there's this underground thing is basically like a vault situation. You know, it's just like in Fallout. He refers to the dog a few times as dog meat, which I thought was interesting. A lot of the area is pretty much desert, and it's pretty much just a wasteland. And what is interesting about it is it's like this wasteland on top of everything else. And you'll see, like, there's these raiders that go around, and they try to blow holes through the sand, and then they dig, and it looks like it's probably about, like, not even 10 feet, maybe 10, 15 feet down, and they can get into, down into, like, buildings and things like that, where they can scavenge for food and everything. And I thought that was pretty interesting. It's almost like there's a layer of sand over everything, and they're able to just go down a few feet and you know, get the supplies they need. I think it's kind of interesting the way they did that. But yeah, the movie, I would highly recommend it for anyone who loves the Fallout games, and also anyone who loves 70s crazy movies, because that's why it was perfect for me. I absolutely love the movie. Now you saw it before me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I just saw it like a couple weeks ago when we were first talking about it. But when you first saw it, what did you think about the movie?
You know, it's funny because when I first saw it, it was shortly – it was – geez, I want to say it was about 8 or 9 years ago. And it's funny how I made the connection to Fallout right away. Now, the funny thing is, I watched it again recently, and I didn't make the dog meat connection till recently. The fact that he calls him dog meat to tick the dog off, and I'm like, oh, duh, dog meat, okay, there, you know. But it was interesting that I did pick up on the Fallout references right off the bat, the fact that they, you know, live in these underground vaults and the whole, you know, the right down to even the fact that there are, like, berserk androids out in the world, and there's that one part, and they allude to it more in the book, and you only get a glimpse of it. They talk about these radioactive mutants called Screamers, and like, if that ain't a feral ghoul, I don't know what is. I mean, one of those, like, glowing ones, like you'd see in Fallout 3. That's what I got. That's what I was thinking. They said the minute you touch them, you would die. And, the first time I saw it, you know, the first half of it, I was kind of scratching my head going, where are they going with this? But the beauty of this film, and this is what finally hooked me, is the movie's literally like two halves. You have this one half where, you know, it's him and the dog, you know, trying to scavenge for food and women in the midst of the underworld, or in the midst of the wasteland, I should say. And then after he gets captured, the movie does this 180 where suddenly he's trapped and captured in this underground vault that where the whole world is being treated like this totalitarian government down below, and all they want for him is basically to take his sperm because their genetics are, you know, they're trying to avoid the inbreeding problem that one would have when you have a small group of people, and the fact that there's a group of people down there that are trying to break him out, and so it almost seemed like two movies in one, and then you know, the relationship with the dog being in the middle of that.
That's a good point. I think, you know, I think the way everything was done was just great. And I watched it, you know, I watched it about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago for the first time. And then I watched it again today, actually, to kind of get ready for this. And there were a lot of things I picked up on the second time. But I think Don Johnson, you know, he was 25 years old when he did this. And his acting in that, I think, was just superb. I mean, he really gets you into it. I thought it was a really great movie. A lot of times you see movies from the 70s or, you know, older movies that you see and you're like, wow, you know, you can tell this is kind of cheesy and, you know, the acting isn't so good and things like that, especially in a low budget independent film, which is basically what this was. But he did a great job. And also, it also has Jason Robards in it as kind of the supreme leader in the underground area in Topeka. And that's pretty interesting too. And one other thing that I thought was pretty interesting was the references to time. You know, this is supposed to take place in 2024, and this movie was made in 1974. So of course they're thinking, oh, this is going to be a long way off. Well, we're getting closer to 2024 now. But Don Johnson's character was actually supposed to be born in 2006, and they talk about World War IV happened in 2007. So I thought that was funny because it's just like, you know, a couple years ago, and here we are watching this old movie. And I guess that's the same with, like, 1984, they did that, where, you know, 1984 was written in 1948, and it's basically, you know, it's supposed to be the distant future, and I remember reading it in school, and it was already past 1984, you know, and it was like, this is the future, oh, and 1984 happened, you know, like, a couple years ago.
that's totally true. Well, and you can tell that, you can see that, especially in the late 70s and early 80s, how much Cold War paranoia was going on. They really were sure we were going to blow ourselves up. And it's something that was interesting, and I didn't pick up on this till watching it the second time around recently. You know, having Jason Robards in it, that man got around, because if you know, those of you who've seen the movie The Day After, which was a very huge nuclear war film, there's Jason Robards again, and I'm like, man, this guy's all over the wasteland, isn't he?
That's true, you know, and I was actually thinking of that too, but I couldn't remember which movie it was that he was in. I was like, you know, I know he's been in another post-apocalyptic movie, and I didn't know if it was Threads or if it was that, and I didn't think it was Threads because Threads was a British movie. And then, yeah, that's exactly right. It was that one, yeah. And we'll have to talk about that one, definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Threads as well, which I just recently saw for the first time, you know, and yeah, we'll be talking about that one. But one thing I wanted to jump in with, too, is one thing that really took me off guard was how well done, because, you know, this was in the 70s, you know, obviously the special effects are going to be hokey, but for being a low-budget film, they made that dog believable. And I have seen a lot of films just recently, and I'll you know, right off the bat, I'm thinking, you know, I saw a preview the other day for this Beverly Hills Chihuahua, and there's another story where there's some dog gonna walk around and he's supposedly talking, and if you look close, you can tell the dog's like looking at a milk bone or something somebody's got off camera. But this dog, he looked like he was really saying those things. And there's like this one particular scene where him and Vic are hiding from the rain underneath this little rooftop area. And they're having this argument, and Blood is all ticked off at him because of something he did. And he's like, come on, Blood, I'm sorry. And the dog's actually turning away like he's ignoring him. And I was watching this going, I cannot believe it. This dog is actually making facial, like almost look like, They had matched it, and I don't know how many takes this must have been, but they were matching every movement that he did with what his voice was saying, and I was baffled by how well done it was.
Yeah. Well, you know something really interesting about that dog? Is that dog was Tiger on the Brady Bunch.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I was reading on Wikipedia. That was the same dog that was Tiger in the Brady Bunch. So he was like... He was already, you know, a seasoned veteran by that time.
Well, I'm sorry. I just start laughing because I just realized this guy went from being like the quintessential family dog to helping Don Johnson rape women. I'm sorry. There was an irony there that I didn't mean to get at that moment, but there it was.
Yeah, it's well. What's kind of sad though is actually I was reading. I got into this. I was reading his like biography today. That dog actually died not too long after A Boy and His Dog was made. They were supposed to make a sequel, and actually they were going to call it A Girl and Her Dog. It was going to be more of a female perspective, and they were for some reason I guess they were going to use the same dog, but he actually died not too long after that. So yeah, but. I just thought that was interesting. It was the Brady Bunch's Tiger, and then it was Blood.
I know, it just seemed kind of weird. It's almost like watching the child star suddenly go rob a video store and or steal clothes out of like Walmart or something. I was just like, well, now that's interesting. But yeah, I mean, for being just a dog, what? Wow. I mean, the things he would say and the way he would look or the way he would limp, and I'm like, my gosh, this doesn't look like there's a trainer off camera. This dog really looks like he's pissed. You know, yeah. I was absolutely baffled by how well that was. It's almost, I don't want to say the dog stole the show, but in many ways he did. And even from the point of view that, you know, Vic is the, kind of the wild child and the dog is very much his tutor, so to speak. He's almost like Obi-Wan to him. And, you know, you shouldn't be doing this and you should be doing that. And oh, come on. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. Yes, you better do that. You know, and you can always tell that the dog is always one step of him and even right down to the moment that he goes down into the vault, you know, the dog's begging him, you know, don't go. You're not going to come back. They're going to get you. I have a bad feeling about that. Oh no, I'll be fine. You know, and look what happened, you know?
Yeah. The dog was the rational one. And, you know, that was another part you were talking about, that scene when they were sitting under that little roof, that overhang, and Vic is yelling at him. And I remember thinking, like, he's just screaming at him, and the dog is just sitting there and looking at him, and then he would look away a few times, like you said. And I remember thinking, like, man, like, I wonder what's going through that dog's mind. You know what I mean? Like, to sit there and have somebody yelling at him, he's probably thinking, you know, he did something bad or something. You know what I mean? But he just sat there and he did his thing and he didn't, you know, get all freaked out. It was pretty cool though.
And one of the funny things too is that just the way that the dog has this like really hilarious, almost like sixth sense of humor, because there's this one line in the book that I get a kick out of, and it's something that he basically is explaining. You'll catch parts where Blood refers to Vic as Albert, and it drives Vic absolutely mad. And the reason he refers to him as Albert is he's referring to an author. Yeah, he basically says, I get such a kick out of calling him Albert after Albert Payson Terhune, who wrote all those stupid dog books in which we noble creatures were pets, always being saved by some sappy human. It is my best gambit to make him scream. So you could tell that the dog is just like ribbing him the whole time and just like has this twisted look on the world. And yet the two of them have this very, you know, this understanding that goes way beyond that's like this really deep friendship. And I just found that really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the ending also, it's interesting because it's like,
it's like,
yeah. And he, you know, there are a few times in the movie where you're wondering if he's going to choose the girl or the dog, you know, I mean, that's the age old question, right? So he doesn't, it's like, you don't know if he's actually going to go with the girl, but the girl, she gets a little crazy, you know, sometimes. And she turns on Vic a few times and then finally, you know, you realize that he actually is going to stay with the dog. Of course, you know, the movie's called Boy and His Dog, so of course he's going to do that. But it's pretty cool. It's like an homage to to friendship. Now, while we wrap this up and get off the main topic, was there anything in the movie that you didn't like?
You know what? That's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, I think everything, there were things about it that they did where I was expecting it to go haywire in that old, you know, in some of those way those 1970s movies do where they seem like they're going to make a point and then for some reason the director did something really dumb. Every time this movie seemed like it was going to do that, it didn't. And it would actually do something that I hadn't thought about. And there's, like, for example, like right down to the detail in the way that when, you know, he's down inside the vault, they used a lot of symbolism to make it so, like, for example, the people down in the vault, like Sean was saying, they wear this mime makeup, and it makes everybody look really weird and creepy, but it's almost like the symbolism behind it, that the fact that these people are living this totalitarian government, and they're almost borderlining insane at times. And the fact that the makeup, you could tell the people wearing the makeup were the ones that were part of that world and were accepting that world, and the ones who weren't were ones that were rebelling from it or fighting from it. Or in the case of Vic, he was somebody who wasn't supposed to be there in the first place. And I thought that was really incredible detail to actually go that far with it.
So basically you're saying you don't have anything you didn't like about
it. You know, I do, yeah, even down to the ending, which to my understanding, I guess the original author was really peeved about the way the ending played out. But I thought the ending was kind of like a funny irony to the whole story, because it's like, here she did try to take him away from his best friend, and how did it play out, you know?
Yeah. I heard that too, that he did not like that at all. For me, I guess I would say the only thing I didn't really like was, it's kind of the classic thing, you know, when there's a book turned into a movie, there's going to be parts left out. And I think that they touched on a lot of parts in the movie, like especially with the Kennedys. You know, there was a part where the dog was drilling him on the presidents, the recent presidents, and he was going through them all. And when he got up to Nixon, and then he said Nixon, Ford, which Ford was the president when this movie was made. And then after that, he said Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy. So they're saying, you know, the Kennedys were, you know, pretty much dominated after that. And I wish they would have touched on that a little bit more, because in the book it explains why the Kennedys pretty much ruled everything. And, you know, the movie doesn't talk about any of that. And it only touches on the fact that there are androids, and it only touches on the fact that the dog is an experiment. And I wish they would have gone a little bit more into that. But, of course, you know, that's the type of thing that you can only really do in a book. So
that's right.
I can see how that wouldn't really work out. But I just wish that I don't know. I guess that would probably be my only thing. But I guess that's pretty common when there's a book turned into a movie.
Yeah. Well, in this case, I think you know, I'm going to probably go back and jump back in the book after having seen the movie again, and, you know, being older, and maybe get all that detail that I had learned a little bit about in the movie from the beginning. So. Did you have a spot in the movie that you would think would be your favorite?
I don't know. I liked there were quite a few. I liked a lot of the scavenging scenes. I thought one scene that pops into my mind right now that I think was really kind of crazy, and it was actually pretty Mad Max. It reminded me a lot of Mad Max, was when there was like that caravan of people. And there was a guy on that caravan. It was like a wheeled cart kind of thing, and it had like draping fabric all over it. And there was like this guy who must have been the leader of this little group, this little gang, and he was being pulled on this cart by all these, I guess they were like his slaves, and they were pulling, and then he had like his guys around him with guns. And they were going to scavenge for food. They were blowing holes in the sand, and then he would have the slaves dig a hole for him. And I thought that whole scene was really cool, the way it was done, because it was like, what's going on here? Why are they doing this? And then you kind of figure it all out. And like, especially when the girl, you find a lot of these holes, you know, where the holes in the sand, they go down. When he meets the girl, he goes down into a building, and it's like a kind of like a pre-war building, and it has like lockers in the background, and there's like furniture and everything. So you can tell that that's what it's doing. But I thought that scene with that guy was, for some reason, just maybe the cinematography of it or something, it was really, really cool. It was a lot like the people in Mad Max, you know, kind of the biker trash, you know, and it reminded me a lot of that. I thought that was a really cool scene, though.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I didn't think about that as far as Mad Max terms. You're exactly right. It was almost like he was sort of the Don, so to speak, you know, and those were his little cronies. And now correct me if I'm wrong. And it, now at the very end, the dog, when he mentions to the dog, you know, let's go back to town, the dog says, we can't, so-and-so took over. We can't ever go back. Was he referring to him, that Don?
I think he was. Yeah. Because, they said that he took over that little town where he went, in this little town. He watched a movie. It was like a, almost like a drive-in, but it was like a sit-in, an outdoor theater. And I guess he went there often to trade and things like that. So I guess this Don guy took over the city.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting. And looking back, you know what? It took me a minute to kind of figure out what my favorite part was. For me, there was one particular scene, and the beauty, like again, the beauty of this movie is that it seems like it kind of 180s halfway through, and you've got this crazy, harsh raider world on the surface, and then down below, you've got this, you know, group of these people living in this weird dystopian world where they're almost all borderlining on insane, and it's almost like who's crazier, the people in the vault or the people up above who are the raiders? And the one part that proves this point, and this is the part that I think out of all of it was the part where I really realized this movie is just insanely brilliant the way they did this. There's this one scene at the very end where Vic is trying to escape with the girl, and her name is Quilla. They're trying to escape out the door, and they're being chased by what is essentially the bodyguard of this vault, and his name is Michael, and he's an android gone nuts. And meanwhile, Jason Robards and the other people in charge of the vault, the committee, as they call them, are sitting there like, and they're writing something down, and they're doing something together as a committee, writing stuff down, and they're not even blinking. And as they look down, and they're like reading things off, all so and so, what's he doing, so and so. And then all of a sudden, there's this gunfight where Vic is shooting at Michael, and Michael's coming after him, and the girl's screaming, and this whole committee, nobody even so much as blinks. Like, they don't even act like it's there. And then in the middle of it, Vic just shoots down Michael, and Michael dies. And he explodes in this, like, burst of sparks and flames, and they take off. And then without even looking up, Jason Robards' character just goes, well, we'll have to get another Michael out of the warehouse, and this time get that damn smirk off of his face. And I thought that was hysterical, that these people not only were so insane and so wrapped up in their world that they didn't even, like, blink at the fact that Vic was off and gone. They were like, well, time to move on to the next phase, so just let's move on. Like, they didn't even care that anything had been happening. And I was just like, seriously, who's more nuts, the people in the vault or the people up above? So
that's
wild.
That's a good point. Yeah, and actually, it's funny because that's another example of something that they carried through in Fallout. You know, they have pretty much the same exact thing in a lot of different, you know, there's not really a committee, but even in Fallout 2, well, Fallout 1 and 2, there were something that represented something like that. So, yeah, definitely, that was a great scene.
War is hell.
All right, run it again.
You're so funny when you're sexually frustrated.
I'm funny enough to kick you upside the butt. I said fine, and I ain't kidding.
One does not say ain't, Albert. Simply say I'm not kidding.
Fine, dog meat. Stop calling me Albert.
Now, you would stone a poor defenseless animal, wouldn't you? Yes, I can tell that you would. I can tell by your short breath and your disgusting, aggressive behavior that you would. And that's because you're not a nice person, Albert. You're not a nice person at all.
Okay, so now we're going to go ahead and read a couple of emails. Now, we got quite a few emails, and I can't read them all. You know, supposed to be an hour show. but you know, I, like I said earlier, I'm so thankful for all these emails. They're really going great. But I just grabbed a couple of them, and I just wanted to read them. And we'll just – a lot of them are mostly suggestions, you know, for other things that people should read or watch. And this first one says, hi, I just finished listening to episode 3, and I'm really loving this show. Both of you briefly discussed reasons people might be interested in post-apocalyptic stories, and I thought some of your conclusions were very thought-provoking. What I enjoy most about post-apocalyptic stories is the how it happened or what happened. For instance, when I saw the ending to the original Planet of the Apes, my mind was blown. Sure, Heston's shocking discovery of the Statue of Liberty had been lampooned for decades, but it made me very curious about what exactly had happened to Earth. I suppose the alternate history aspect of post-apocalyptic is what I'm interested in seeing. As Sean said, we live with the threat of war every day, so it is fascinating to me how authors and game designers can tweak a tiny bit of history and create places like Bartertown or Capital Wasteland. Anyway, I recently watched a movie that I think you might enjoy. It's called Dance of the Dead, and it's part of Showtime's Masters of Horror series. It's directed by Tobe Hooper, who did Poltergeist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and stars Robert Englund, who you might know from he's Freddy Krueger from the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. At first, it seems like just another tired and terrible of the dead gore fest, but the setting and plot are surprisingly original for something of this genre. Here's a link to the Netflix page for the movie, and he includes a little link there, which I'm definitely going to check that out. And he says, keep up the good work from Rory. So yeah, thanks Rory. That's that suggestion there. Like I said, I'm going to check this out. And if Jonathan and I watch this and it's something we love, we will definitely talk about it on the show.
Definitely. Yeah. And I share his, what he said about having, you know, having this fascination with the way it happens, you know, watching the world kind of tear itself apart. And this, you know, this, that's why one of the, you know, that movie we mentioned, the day after, I thought that was really interesting. What drew me to it was the fact that you kind of get to watch the world take itself apart. Same with Threads for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess you could say we'll add it to the list because there's so many.
Add it to our Netflix queue.
Yes, yes. See, that's another thing is Jonathan and I both have Netflix, and we, before we do a show, like the week before, we're like, add this movie to your list. We're going to talk about this. So, it's being added to the queue, definitely.
All right. The next email says, hello, Sean and Jonathan. Love the show. Post-apocalyptic themes genre has always been one of my favorites. Anyway, two titles you may or may have not heard of. The first is a book to add to your collection called The Day of the Triffids. And this is funny because I actually have heard of this. It's a pretty good read, written in the 1950s, so it's a little old-fashioned, but pretty good. The alien plants are a little naff, but they don't distract too much from the main plot. Forget the TV series, he says. The BBC did one in the 70s or 80s, and it wasn't too good, which is, that's why I kind of laughed, is because I've actually seen the BBC one. and it's interesting, you know, it's basically kind of like Little Shop of Horrors kind of a story, where all of the plants in our world, there's these things called the Triffids that pretty much take over our entire planet. It's pretty fascinating. I have never read the book, but I remember seeing glimpses of the BBC one, and as goofy as it was, it freaked me out as a little kid, so. And then it says, the second is a really cheesy B-movie called Radioactive Dreams. And he says, I remember watching this on video when I was about 13 years old and loved it. Amazing how your taste develops with age. If I can remember, it was about these two young men that grow up in some sort of bunker listening to only 1920s and 30s and 40s music, not sure which, reading detective novels and watching black and white movies. Then they leave the bunker and explore the wastelands, and the rest, well, I can't really remember. I do remember mutants and 1940s style dancing. It sounds like a very odd combination, eh? Good luck, and I look forward to more good stuff from you two. Signed, Guy. And it's funny because as he was mentioning that, it sounds a lot like, for a split second, I was hearing, you ever seen that movie Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser where he was down in the vault for so long? And we're calling the vaults now, the bomb shelters. We're calling the vault by default. How's that? You know, the same type of thing where he kind of grew up with the 1950s, type of world and coming out of it was like, ah! So I'm going to definitely have to check this Radioactive Dreams out. This really caught my eye when he was explaining what the fact that these people lived down there and then had to come out and deal with the wasteland after that.
Yeah, and the other one he mentions about the Day of the Triffids, that's interesting too because it's like the previous email, you know, you want to know how it happened. And I think the fact that plants did it, I think that's pretty interesting. So yeah, if I can find that one, I'm going to check it out definitely.
Definitely.
Okay, our next email, this is the last one we're going to read here as far as emails. It says, hey guys, I came across your show after the Mad Max episode was posted and I'm really enjoying it so far. Post-apocalyptic stuff has been my favorite genre for a good 25 years now, primarily books. I have to admit, I'm not a gamer, so have never played any of the games you discuss, but I'm just happy that there's a post-apocalyptic podcast out there at all. Regarding Mad Max, I've never considered it post-apocalyptic specifically. It definitely takes place when society is starting to crumble, but the fact that they have a police force and hospitals and such shows that there are still strong remnants of civilization existing. In my mind, the apocalypse that led to Road Warrior happened after the events of Mad Max, but I haven't seen it for years, so I may be wrong. It was still a great movie and episode, regardless of the technicality of it. For spoilers, I like your thoughts on a case-by-case basis, with consideration given to how widespread the knowledge of the details are. And in any case, if you give us a warning, we can always fast-forward that part. It's very true. Your discussion of how different countries view the post-apocalyptic genre reminded me of a book that I've been looking for forever, but have never read, called Malevil? Is that, you think that's how it's
Malevil?
Pronounced?
Malevil?
Malevil? Okay. By Robert Merle. I think that's how it's pronounced. And then he gives the Wikipedia page for it, and I'll put that in the show notes. He says it was written in French in the 70s, but I'm pretty sure an English translation exists. I was always curious to see if they see themselves as innocent bystanders of a war between the U.S. and Russia, or if they see themselves as having had some part of it. Would love to hear if any of your listeners know where I can get a copy, or an ebook would be fantastic. Now, actually, just to break in here for a second, that's actually pretty much what Threads is about. You know, England is kind of the innocent bystanders between the U.S. and Russia, and that's a great movie, and that is definitely on the list.
Yes, definitely. Very, very close, in fact, just because of how grisly it can be at times. It's almost like almost the top of my own.
Yeah. And then he continues and he just says, a little shameless plug. A few years back, I set up a personal blog to keep track of my thoughts on PA books I've read or wanted to read. But over time, I started writing more as if there was an audience listening, which there is not as of yet, he says. And this is Doomorama.com. He's the one who sent he didn't send it. The thing I mentioned before about the definitions of the genres of post-apocalyptic and apocalyptic and all that, that was from his Twitter. I kind of stole it from his Twitter. But his little blog is Doomorama.com, and I will put a link to that in the show notes as well. It says, keep up the good work, and I look forward to the next show. Bill in Hawaii.
You know, he made me think of something that I hadn't really given a lot of consideration to, and he mentions, you know, the fact that, you know, at what point does Mad Max become the nuclear war area? You know, because in Road Warrior, it's very obvious there's a nuclear war. They mention it in the very beginning, but Mad Max, it's sort of not really touched on. And after thinking about it, this is my take on it, and it's very quick, but I thought I'd throw it in just because of what he mentioned. My take on it is that during Mad Max, he's sort of so far in the outback that that their part of the civilization hasn't really been touched, very much like Jericho. The fact that, you know, the U.S. has been attacked, or supposedly attacked, and yet Jericho seems to be functioning just fine. People are still driving cars. And that's how I kind of viewed that, as his particular area that he lived in with his wife had not really been directly touched. But that later in the story, maybe he ventures out further into the wasteland for whatever reason, and now he's getting closer and closer to where some of these horrific things happen, and you notice at the end of Road Warrior, you know, they're very close to where the cities were. And so that's kind of, you know, that kind of made me think maybe that's how I kind of viewed as the continuity there.
Yeah, that's a good point. I pretty much share that. I think that's very viable. But I think, as a twist to that, I think that maybe the guys who wrote Mad Max, they didn't really plan it that far. I think that they were concentrating more on the story of him and his family, and the fact that, you know, he got his family got killed by basically raiders, you know, and that he was going after that. And then I think once Road Warrior was written, I think they said, you know what, we need to go back and kind of explain what happened and why there was a societal downfall and everything. So I think that it was almost written kind of to go back and explain that. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the way I feel. I don't think that the nuclear war happened between Mad Max and Road Warrior, though. I don't think that that's what happened, because that would be, you know, he was only a couple of years older, and there's no way you could recover from a nuclear, you know, devastation like that.
Yeah.
And plus, he was basically driving the same car, you know.
Well, it's very much, you know, Hobbit versus Lord of the Rings, where in The Hobbit, he wrote the story as its own, and then Lord of the Rings, he had to sort of explain how they got to that point. So, yeah, that's interesting.
That's actually a great comparison. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so we have a couple comments here that I wanted to read really quick before we close out the show. And these are comments from the Virgin Worlds listeners over at virginworlds.com. And over there, of course, on each show, you can leave your own comments if you're not familiar with it. You can go over there and you can leave comments for us or for other people. And you can, it works kind of like a discussion where people can talk about, you know, about the show and what we talk about. So I wanted to read a few of them. This isn't all of them. It's just a few that I picked out. And one of them is the first one is from Puffin Stuff. Yes, that's his name. And he says, okay, first I wanted to say, oh my God, you said Threads on this podcast. Yes, we did. We said it on this one too, actually. Looking forward to your assessment of it. That will be coming soon. However, I'm asking you again on your definition of the genre. Where do movies like Logan's Run, The Handmaid's Tale, Gattaca, and Soylent Green fall? None of these are truly post-disaster, though each highlights a crisis: population, religious fanaticism, perfect genetics, and food. All are real fears, and each of these movies touch on dystopia, yet none are really post a disaster, except for maybe Logan's Run. These are all also wonderful social commentaries, and I had always put in this genre. Am I off base here?
Interesting.
I don't think he is.
I don't think he is either.
But I think that with that the article I was talking about earlier, and they mentioned Handmaid's Tale, and they mentioned Soylent Green as kind of the dystopian thing. And to me, I don't know, especially like Gattaca, it's not really – to me, that's not what we're really going to cover, I think. Gattaca was more I don't know. It's almost like 12 Monkeys is kind of in the same vein. It's like – I like – and I think Jonathan might disagree with this, but what I think of when I think of post-apocalyptic is just a devastation, you know, and kind of rebuilding and scavenging. That's the part I like. I really enjoy that part. And that's what I would really like to focus on with this podcast. And, you know, he says in here, I'm asking you once again for your definition of the genre. I think he wrote in before, and we probably didn't cover it well enough. But I think the main reason we didn't cover it well enough is because it's so open, you know, it's so open to interpretation. That I'm sure there's going to be times when we're going to talk about other things besides just a nuclear holocaust or just a complete devastation situation. I'm sure there's other things we can talk about. So I want to leave it open, and I want to be able to talk about those other things. And I'm sure we'll do it. But that said, I would really like to focus on the devastated Earth type of a scenario.
Well,
so
yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, see, and I'm with you on that. I mean, it's, you know, I totally agree with you the way you said that it pretty much would focus on a situation where the, you know, civilization fell for whatever reason, and it's not just a simple, it's on a level that we haven't seen yet, and that a lot of the story focuses on the survival aspect of it, and I think that's hitting it right on the head. I mean, Fallout and all these games are all about how these people live after this event takes place, and I'm with you on that part. I think, you know, like he says, you know, I think I would probably classify, even though they're dystopian and yet none of them are really a disaster, I still would put a lot of those into dystopian just because, you know, you've got like Logan's Run and Gattaca and Soylent Green, everything's, there's sort of a Big Brother level to the whole world and everybody's sort of following in line to do, whether or not they're happy with it, they're having to, you know, get into the food lines or in the case of Logan's Run, having to go to Carousel. But, you know, like you said, I think that, you know, keeping it more at the, you know, the post-disaster type of storyline, I think that I agree with you that would be kind of how I've always pictured where we take the story, with the option, like you said, to keep it open if we wanted to jump across.
Yeah. Yeah. The main thing will be post-disaster. But, yeah, we might dive into some of the other stuff because I think it does pertain a little bit. So
definitely. All right. Well, the next comment on Virgin Worlds was from Sanjuro, and I hope I pronounced that right. It said, regarding I Am Legend, if you are a fan of post-apocalyptic fiction, then this is a must read. Also, in case you didn't know, the Will Smith picture was the third time this book has been adapted to film, and in my opinion, the worst adaptation. It was preceded by The Omega Man, 1971, starring Charlton Heston, fantastic movie. I'm going to jump in there and say that. And The Last Man on Earth, 1964, starring Vincent Price, which, jumping ahead there, my dad, that's still the one movie that scares the hell out of my father to this day, so that's interesting. The latter being the most faithful to the novel. I must say that Omega Man is a must-see for anyone who's interested in a post-apocalyptic or dystopian film. This was one of three dystopian films Heston starred in, the others being Planet of the Apes, Omega Man, and Soylent Green. Younger folks may find the film campy, but I think it's a classic of the genre. Also, a rare, little-known, and hard-to-find classic of this genre is The Ultimate Warrior, 1975, starring Yul Brynner, another must-see, in my opinion. And lastly, I'd like to make a small comment about the appeal of post-apocalyptic fiction, films, and games. I think much of this is rooted in the narrative of the American West. In many ways, the elements of post-apocalyptic stories mirror ideas of the American frontier and the West. The first Mad Max film is very much a story of a frontier town lawman pushed to the breaking point and going to extremes to deal with bandits. Self-reliance, harsh conditions, semi-lawless society, everyone armed, bandits and wild peoples, strange landscapes, etc. All of these are elements of the Western narrative and post-apocalyptic narrative, and they have universal appeal. And then in another comment from him, he also mentioned, one more thing I'd like to add, I think all cultures throughout history have had stories, tales, myths, visions, nightmares, or the big end. The finish and the destruction of their world, but in American culture, we not only dwell on the end, but we obsess with the after. I think this, again, has to do with the American character and the narrative of self-reliance and independence that is such a large part of the American psyche. So not only do we have films like Failsafe from 1964, Dr. Strangelove, also from 1964, which are really about the end or how the end could happen, but we have other films and books that could focus on what we do after it happens. And I think this is really an American take on the end of time story, and that's from Sanjuro. And wow, some fascinating comments there. I had never put it into the American West idea, but he is absolutely correct. There is a lot of parallels there that never dawned on me.
Yeah, and I think that we talked about that a little bit earlier with Mad Max, and some people might not even consider it a true post-apocalyptic movie because there's no real destruction and wasteland, things like that. But the fact is, you know, it really influenced a lot of post-apocalyptic movies. But yeah, I think that's a great point there, is that it's more of like a Western, you know, the classic Western plot.
Well, and it dawns on me too, and you know, here's another light bulb going off and another slap in my head for not figuring this out sooner. Stephen King obviously had that figured out because everything that The Gunslinger deals with is exactly that middle ground between the wild, yeah. Wild West and the end of the world. And I don't know why that never dawned on me. I mean, obviously Stephen King is a bigger genius than even I gave him credit for. And that's saying a lot because I think the guy is a genius. So, wow. Now, I mean, that almost makes me want to go back and read The Gunslinger novels just from the point of view of looking at the parallel there.
And like you said, we're probably going to talk about that, you know, somewhere down the line. And I guess this would be a good parallel there to make that comparison between the Westerns and, you know, I think that maybe the appeal with Westerns is not only the storyline of a classic Western, but also just the fact that, you know, you have the wide open spaces and you have the kind of desolation and everything. And I think that's a big part of the post-apocalyptic movies and of Westerns.
Definitely. Yeah, he gave some very good ideas. I'm going to be pondering on that one for quite some time.
So I guess we have one more comment, and it's a real quick one. I just want to talk about real quick. And this is from Julie, who we mentioned earlier from the No Prisoners, No Mercy podcast. And she just simply says, how about a little more discussion on what you gents are expecting out of Fallen Earth?
Wow.
So, yeah. I guess there's not really a lot we can say right now. You know, the game is in beta, and there's not really a lot that anyone can say about the game aside from what's already out there. You know, we have screenshots. We have a pretty nice definition of what they're going to do with the game as far as, like we've mentioned, you know, they have the 95% of the items are going to be craftable by players, which is really exciting. A classless system, pretty much. I think things like that are really enticing to me. Of course, there's the post-apocalyptic setting, which is always very exciting. You know, especially nowadays, it seems like more and more people are making those types of games. And, you know, we have Earthrise, we have this, we have Global Agenda, which is coming out. So I guess what I'm basically saying is I don't know what to expect completely. You know, the game, from what we know about it right now, it seems like it'll be really interesting. And I'm very excited about it. And I will probably buy it, you know, just from what we know about it already. Other than that, though, you know, there's not really much that can be said.
You know what? That was very interesting. And I thought on that question for some time. And, you know, like you said, you know, obviously we don't know a ton yet, or we can't talk about yet. But the one thing that did dawn on me, and this falls within the realms of what we already know from what they've told us. The fact that they are making it so 95% of the items can be crafted, is giving me, it kind of makes me excited for that alone, because not just because in online games I love to be the crafter type, but the fact that by doing this, they're giving this online game, you know, here we are talking about, you know, post-apocalyptic genre and the fact that we love the survival aspect. And, you know, when you and I talked about Fallout 3, we touched on one of the coolest features was the fact that you could scavenge weapons together to make a better weapon. And by making 95% of the items be craftable and having to go out and find the the pieces to do this and then put them together, is definitely adding an element to this Fallen Earth game to give you that survival feeling right from the get-go. There are no, you know, necessarily vendors who are going to sell you the best items. You have to get the stuff yourself or find someone who can get it for you. And that right there already gives it a survival feeling that most games don't have. And truth be told, you know, obviously we've got this gaga feeling because this is the first, you know, online game that's dealing with this kind of a setting, but I will say I'm expecting a lot, and I think in the end we will probably be happy just from the fact that we are able to run around in the world we dreamed we could try to run around in. And the fact that it has to do, the fact that it deals with an area that just happens to be within about 70 miles of where I live is just tickles me to death. But, yeah, I'm excited to see where Fallen Earth goes, and I know for certain we will be talking about this in the future.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think kind of a basic breakdown, you know, people are going to inevitably be comparing Fallen Earth with Earthrise. You know, those are the two big ones that are the post-apocalyptic games, you know, MMOs that are coming out. So people, I've already been asked on another podcast I do about what's the difference between the two. You know, can you tell us a little bit of the features? And I think that it just basically breaks down to the fact, like Jonathan said, Fallen Earth is going to be a survival game about scavenging and those types of things that I really love. Earthrise is going to be more like more technological. There's going to be more, you know, Earth has been devastated, but at the same time, there's still technology. There's still, you know, like power armor type situations, you know, things like that. But right. There's no power armor, or at least I don't know for sure, but from what I can gather, there's not really any kind of a power armor type thing in Fallen Earth because you're making your own stuff and, you know, you have baseball bats and you have, you know, 3D glasses, like they said in that interview. But yeah, you're scavenging more. You're doing more things like that. And that right there is intriguing to me. Now, I think that between the two, as far as making a comparison, I think that Earthrise is going to be a prettier game. I think it's probably going to be a little bit better looking. But, you know, that can only go so far. So I'm really excited to see what Fallen Earth can offer for the inner scavenger in me.
Oh, definitely. Well, and you know, something else that occurs to me now, another difference that I didn't think about before, and correct me if I'm wrong, Fallen Earth versus Earthrise, Fallen Earth seems to share a lot of that dark humor that the Fallout games have. I mean, you know, the oh my god waffles, you know, I mean, when I heard that, I was like, oh, this is right out of Fallout, that same kind of hilarious humor where the world, despite being blown apart, or, you know, nuked and the virus killed everybody, the fact that everybody, it still has this twisted humor underneath it, whereas Earthrise seems to be more of a serious game. You know, it's very much the kind of the way, and hopefully nobody cringes here, but you know, like Tabula Rasa, it was a game where we had a lot of this technology and things were much more serious, and the kind of survival was taken in a much more real and serious light, whereas, you know, Fallen Earth, it's almost like we're kind of laughing as we do this. And I gotta say, the laughter part, the dark humor, I'm really attracted to that, and probably from the Fallout games growing up with them, but I have a high expectations for both, and watch us, we'll both be playing both, I can feel it.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a given. So yeah, that's, I guess that'll about do it for this show. Wow, this is a long one. But, I mean, it's funny, we get longer and longer every time. We say we wanted to try to keep it at 45 minutes, but that's, We just have so much to say.
I know. We just wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't say what we wanted to say.
Very, very true. So I guess to wrap it up, we just wanted to say go on over to virginworlds.com and check us out over there because we're part of the Virgin Worlds Collective, and it's basically just a big collective of MMO podcasts. So if you are looking for something on another game you enjoy, there's probably a good chance you'll find it over there. So go check that out over at virginworlds.com. You can check out our page where you can leave a comment for us. And, of course, don't forget about our Facebook page, which will be linked in the show notes, and our you know, Pride and Joy, the Twitter page, which is where I try to update as much as I can whenever I see a you know, anything that has to do with post-apocalyptic, any kind of news story. And most of the stories that we talk about in each episode are Twittered by me. I usually Twitter them, and then at the end, when we're about to record, I go through all the stories that I Twittered, and I compile them for the show notes for each show. So there's a good chance that if you follow us on Twitter, you'll see a lot of these stories before we actually record. So if you have Twitter, you should definitely follow us and check us out on there.
Definitely.
But that'll be it from us. And I just want to thank everyone for listening again, and thanks for the emails and everything. And most importantly than anything else, of course, stay alive out there.
Stay alive. Ham radio for the win.